It now gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, who is Judge Weeramantry. I'm sure that many of you will know of his position in the ICJ advisory opinion. So he will now speak on that opinion and something of what's happened since 96.
It gives me the greatest pleasure to be able to address an audience of such dedicated workers in the cause of the abolition of nuclear weapons, which, after all, is the primal, the most important question before the citizens of this planet. It has the potential, as we all know, to destroy all that civilization has built up over thousands of years of effort. And we are, in a sense, sleepwalking into danger because there is the fact that nuclear weapons have not been used for 60 years, and that has lulled the population of the world into a sense of security. It has not happened so long. It is unlikely to happen. But the dangers are increasing, and the problem is becoming ever more immediate and urgent. And that is why a conference of this sort is most opportune. And now the judgment or the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice was a historic event on the route to the abolition of nuclear weapons because it laid down categorically for the first time the fact that the various principles of international law contained in customary international law and international humanitarian law were categorical enough, any one of them, any one of a series of about 15 different rules, any one of them was strong enough to outlaw nuclear weapons altogether. Now, the opinion of the court was historic because it gathered together a tremendous amount of cooperative effort from across the world. And we were amazed in the court at the number of people who gathered in the vicinity of the court, as well as the enormous number of petitions we received. They numbered millions, millions of signatures, millions of documents. In fact, we had no room in our very spacious archival rooms in the Peace Palace to accommodate all this mountain of material, and we had to accommodate it somewhere else. There were people who came from all over the world to give evidence before the court, and they told us the most harrowing tales of the suffering that nuclear weapons cause. There were the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There were people from different areas affected by nuclear weapons. We all remember graphically the evidence of a lady from the Marshall Islands who said, "We have come all the way from the Marshall Islands to tell you, judges of the court, how harrowing are the sufferings our people have endured since the nuclear bombs were first exploded in our area. We have children born with two heads, children deformed in various ways, and the jellyfish babies who are so abnormal that you can hardly call them human beings. That was very, very harrowing evidence. And in that fashion, we had a lot of evidence from different parts of the world in relation to the effects of nuclear weapons. Now, the case was so significant that perhaps for the first time in the entire history of the court, every judge who participated wrote a separate opinion. They all expressed themselves as fully as they could on this, and the case attracted a vast amount of international publicity. We are pleased to see that since then, it has been recognized in some of the parliaments of the world. It has been recognized by General Assembly resolutions every year in the United Nations. And we also see it being cited where peace activists are charged. And there is a whole series of cases where effect has been given to the opinion of the court, and the activists who were charged with various offenses have been completely acquitted. Now, the features of the opinion, which are most important, are first of all that the opinion drew upon the rich repository of principles of humanitarian law contained in what we call customary international law. Now, there is a false belief on the part of many members of the general public that you need a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. In fact, that argument was seriously adduced before the court by some of the countries supporting nuclear weapons. You do not need a treaty. The weapon already stands condemned by the universal principles of law, which are contained in that rich repository of principles, which we call customary international law. Those have grown up over the ages because humanity has always been very sensitive to the cruel and unnecessary suffering that some weapons might impose. For example, the Lateran Council in the 12th century, a council of the doctors of the church, said that the crossbow and the siege engine, which were new weapons at that time, were too cruel to be used in warfare among Christian nations. And you get that sort of tradition in all cultures. For example, in Hindu law, you have a very famous example of a hyper-destructive weapon being said to be available to the commanders of the time. In the Ramayana, as well as in the Mahabharata, you have a reference to this, that a hyper-destructive weapon which could ravage the countryside of the enemy and kill thousands of their soldiers in one stroke had been said to be available at that time. But the leaders of the time were told, you shall not use this weapon without first consulting the sages of the law. So the sages of the law were consulted, and they said, you cannot use this weapon in war because it goes beyond the purposes of war. The purpose of war is not to annihilate your opponent, but to subdue him and then talk peace with him and live thereafter in peace with him. And this goes beyond the purposes of war. So you get it in the Hindu tradition. Every tradition you can think of. Islamic law is very strict on the fact that there should not be weapons that cause unnecessary suffering, like barbed arrows. Then we have all the so-called, as they like to describe themselves in the 19th century, the civilized nations of the world. They met at various peace conferences, and then they decided that the dum-dum bullet, which had been invented at that time, which explodes on entry into the human body, that the dum-dum bullet was too cruel to be used in warfare among civilized nations. And the civilized nations of the world fully accept that proposition. The dum-dum bullet is too wicked to be used in war. But some of those same nations say the nuclear weapon can be used. The absurdity of it is evident to any child of 10 or any visitor from outer space. But that is the absurdity of the proposition that nuclear weapons can legally be used. So the important fact about this opinion is that it drew upon that rich repository of customary principles of international law and announced to the world that nuclear weapons needed no special treaty to ban them. They were already condemned outright and downright by a whole battery of principles of customary international law. So that is very clear. And the only little opportunity for their use, which the court, by a majority of one, left open was this, that the court would not express an opinion in one situation only. And that was a situation of extreme self-defense, where the very survival of a state was at stake. In regard to that situation, the majority of judges, by one, they said that they would not wish to express an opinion. But there were dissenting opinions. I was among the dissenters who said that there would be an absolute prohibition of nuclear weapons in all circumstances whatsoever. So nuclear weapons stood roundly condemned by this judgment. And another important portion of this judgment was the unanimous statement by all the judges of the court that there was an obligation on the nuclear powers to pursue in good faith and bring to a conclusion negotiations leading to the nuclear disarmament in all its aspects under strict and effective international supervision. Now, that is the keynote part of this judgment, which 10 years later, it is our obligation to examine with a view to seeing to what extent this unanimous opinion of the highest court in the world, the supreme statement, the supremely authoritative statement of international law, has been followed by the nations of the world. And that is one of the important matters that will have to be considered at conferences like this. It is important that we examine this now, because the danger, as I said, is growing. There is a proliferation of nuclear states. There is a proliferation of movements that are prepared to resort to terrorism, and terrorists would like to have their hands on nuclear weapons. The knowledge to make a nuclear weapon is getting disseminated at an alarming rate on internet and everywhere else. There is a tendency to ignore international law, and sometimes to trample it underfoot. There is the fact that there are a number of neutral states who fear that any nuclear explosion, any nuclear exchange between two states will irretrievably damage their populations and their environment. And there is a whole series of little skirmishes and wars going on all over the world, which can at any time perhaps attract the use of a nuclear weapon. Furthermore, there is this factor that if a nuclear weapon happens to be used again, it will not be in a world where there is no potential for nuclear retaliation. It will be in a world where the potential for nuclear retaliation is also there, and there could possibly be an exchange of nuclear weapons which could lead to dire consequences. So all of these are factors that underline the importance of looking at this matter now, looking at it urgently, looking at it with a view to bringing this to some sort of acceptable conclusion. Now, on the aspect of good faith, which is the crux of this decision, the nuclear powers have, in good faith, to take meaningful steps to put an end to their possession of nuclear weapons. The concept of good faith, of course, can be analyzed in extenso, because all legal traditions of the world have got this tradition of good faith as opposed to merely applying the letter of the law, and good faith has been expanded in the literature, not only of legal systems that have written legal systems, but also traditional legal systems. So we find the Roman law, the canon law, the civil law, the Hindu law, Buddhist law, Islamic law, all of them expanding on the concept of good faith and saying that if parties are in negotiation with each other or under a duty to do something in good faith in all its aspects must be fully observed. In Hindu law, there is a lot of literature on dharmishta, or rightful or righteous conduct, and good faith comes under that. In African traditional law, there is a lot of emphasis on good faith, as we read from literature that has been emerging recently about the richness of African traditional law. And my friends from New Zealand were telling me the other day about how Maori law also has this emphasis on good faith in one's relations with neighbours. So good faith in law is a very ancient concept. It is a very broad concept. It is a very meaningful concept. And it has so many different aspects. It means there has got to be correspondence between word and deed. Let us ask ourselves whether the nuclear powers are observing all of this. Is there correspondence between word and deed? Are declarations matched by corresponding actions? Are there secret reservations? All of this militates against good faith. Is there openness and transparency? Is there a complete disclosure of relevant facts? Is there a readiness to submit one's actions to external scrutiny? Are meaningful steps being taken towards this declared goal? Is there any dissembling? Is there any backtracking? Is there sincerity in desiring to achieve this? Is there are they refraining from taking steps that militate against their goal? One can announce that one is committed to disarmament, but at the same time develop or refine nuclear weapons. Well, that is tracking backwards when one should be moving forwards, and that's a total contradiction of the concept of good faith. Are there indefinite postponements which show that one is not serious? Is there a reasonable time span that has been set? Is there cooperation with others who need to be joined with in this enormous task? Is there something that indicates a continuity of efforts, or is there suddenly a burst of activity and then a cessation and then a renewal of activity? Are the proposals of other parties being considered? Is there irreversibility of action? And so forth. One could go on for quite a long time examining the implications of good faith, and it is for us as citizens of planet Earth to ask ourselves whether the main powers that are committed with this solemn responsibility before planet Earth and all its inhabitants, whether they are complying with the obligation stated in the most authoritative fashion by the highest court in the world, that they should get rid of their arsenals and move in good faith towards that result. So these are all questions that we have to consider. I'm delighted that I had the opportunity of addressing such an influential group and dedicated group of peace workers. And I do hope that now that we are marking the 10th anniversary of this historic judgment, we will concentrate our efforts once again and revive the fading embers of that anti-nuclear flame that once burnt very bright, but somehow seems to have been somewhat extinguished. So I wish you all well in your deliberations, and I thank you once again for the opportunity I have had of speaking to you. Thank you.
Studios in